You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. I'm speaking with Thomas Frank. He's the author of What's the Matter with Kansas and The Wrecking Crew. There's a new movie out based on his book, What's the Matter with Kansas. Thank you for joining me, Thomas.
Anytime, Rick.
Tell us a little bit, where is the movie now?
Well, the movie just started a theatrical release in New York City, and so I was out there promoting it. It was Kansas Comes to the Big City.
Wow, that's a big change.
It was kind of funny. In this tiny little theater off of, you know, the Times Square, the theater district, tiny little theater, you know, in this, you know, busy city with all the honking traffic, people looking at pictures of the Great Plains.
So ironic. Now, I understand that you're on some new digs. You've essentially moved from Salt Lake to Lake Tahoe, sort of.
That's like some kind of Utah joke, isn't it?
Well, it's a saltwater to freshwater. I think you're going to be happier in your freshwater environment.
What's happened is I've been a weekly columnist at the Wall Street Journal, and that stops as of next week. And then I'm going to start being a monthly columnist for Harper's Magazine, beginning in their December issue, which I think will be out in November. And I'm really looking forward to it. I'm a contributing editor for Harper's. I've been one for a long time. I've written a bunch of stories for them, and it's always been sort of my favorite magazine in America. And so for me, it feels like a good fit.
Coming home, those clear, cold waters of Lake Tahoe. What more can you ask? We're going to talk a little bit about history today, but maybe not history as it happened.
No, but that's the thing about history is, you know, I got a PhD in history. That was what, you know, I got out of graduate school, and I wanted to be a historian. And the history discipline sort of looks down on what they call presentism, people that want to tell history and understand history in order to serve some present-day purpose. Now, we all do it, and there's no way around it. I mean, it happens whether you deliberately or unconsciously. But it's thought to be a bad thing in history land. But one of the themes, you know, you've read my Wall Street Journal columns over the years, and one of the themes that I constantly hit is the sort of abuse of history by political figures. You know, and it's just constant. And I would say that there's probably one example of this in every single one of my columns, of somebody just, you know, getting something incredibly wrong last week, you know, usually deliberately wrong. But what I started noticing with the sort of modern day, present day conservative movement, you know, and they're very, they're fascinated by history. They're in love with history. You know, they wear...
Well, they're in love with something, but it may be
not
history. Something.
They think it's history. But they wear three-cornered hats to the protest. And there was this great story in the Washington Post the other day about Tea Party people going to Colonial Williamsburg and arguing with the tour guides, you know, Tea Party types, you know. And they're in love with history, but they understand it in this sort of logically upside-down way. Now, I don't remember what the Latin name for this logical fallacy is, but basically they have this theoretical preconception of what history is, what history proved, what history shows, and then they go back into history and sort of use its trap and say, see, like the Boston Tea Party. Okay, let's just choose the big example that everyone talks about nowadays, you know, the idea that it is a tax revolt, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, it was that partially, but it was also partially it was protectionist. Mm-hmm. It was against dumping. The East India Company had gotten the okay from the British government to basically dump huge quantities of cheap tea in America, and it would have put all the local merchants, the American merchants, tea merchants, out of business, as well as smugglers. There was a big trade, and it was a lot of smuggling at the time going on. It would, all would have been put out of business. Well, this is very interesting, you know, and when you study that period in American history, there's, you know, all sorts of things like that crop up, like the involvement of working class people and working class interests in the American Revolution. But to talk to the Tea Party types, you know, none of that ever happened. It's a tax revolt, plain and simple. It doesn't have anything to do with the East India Company.
Well, they were like the BP of their day, in a sense.
Yes, they were very bad. Well, they were. I don't know if you. I mean, things like them, things like the East India Company, fascinate me because, you know, it's technically, it wasn't the British Army that subdued India. It was the East India Company and its own private army. It's fascinating. And the colonists, by the way, weren't ignorant of this. They made a lot of hay out of this. This just seemed monstrous to them that you had a private company that had its own army, you know, and that had reduced India to this state of servitude. And they talked about this all the time. It really frightened them. And here they are coming to America now, and who knows what they're going to do. You know, and that was a big part of the Boston Tea Party. Anyhow, that was just something that I pointed out in an article. I've already wasted half of our time, haven't I?
Oh, no. No, we're just getting started.
Okay. I talked about that in an article about Rand Paul. A couple weeks ago, Glenn Beck. You know, he sort of every time I write about Glenn Beck, there's some horrible whopper that comes up. Like at one time, he said Woodrow Wilson was responsible for Prohibition, and I can understand he doesn't like Woodrow Wilson. He thinks that Wilson was a progressive. Beck thinks that progressives are people who meddle in your affairs, in your the things that ought to be left up to you, and so therefore. You know, and there were a lot of progressives that were in favor of Prohibition. Therefore, Wilson was in favor of Prohibition. It makes sense, right? But it's not true. Wilson was a Democrat. No. Democrats tended to be against it. Wilson actually vetoed the Volstead Act, which is what Prohibition was based on. Another example, who's a senator from South Carolina, Jim DeMint.
DeMint.
Wrote a book last year that I read as part of my research. And in it, he just was throwing off, you know, various facts about this, that, and the other. And he said that Western Europe, sort of all the, after World War II, all of the Western European countries, with the exception of Germany, went for socialist or labor parties. And this is, by and large, this is true. But then he says, and then they all sank into economic decline as a result of that. And it's like as a result of this, of choosing these socialist parties. And I thought about that for a second, and I'm like, but there... It's well known that, like, that's what the French call this the Glorious 30, the years after the war, when they boomed. I mean, they had a boom unprecedented in French history. I looked it up. In Norway had the same. Sweden did, too. In Italy, they have a different name for it, but the same thing, this unprecedented boom, a boom that was had never, like, nothing that had ever happened before in Italian history. And he just, because he thinks they should have declined into, you know, stagnation, they did, right? And so, you know, les Trente Glorieuses, it never happened, right? You know? And there's hundreds of examples of things like this that I've been pointing out here and there when I can of the sort of the fixed idea comes first and the facts are bent to fit, you know, the available space, or the facts aren't mentioned, or they're just invented, you know. Last week, I wrote a column about Newt Gingrich, and Newt intrigues me because he's a bona fide historian. He's not a buff, you know. He's not dabbling in it. He's not getting his facts from, you know, his trip to Colonial Williamsburg. He's the real deal. Now he does write historical fiction, but I think we can forgive him that. And I should mention to your listeners, I've read some of Newt's historical fiction, and I am loath to admit it, I kind of enjoyed it.
Now, let's be clear, though. This isn't historical fiction set in actual history.
No, it's all made up.
It's alternate history.
The book of his that I read was about, it was an alternate history of World War II. Yeah, I think it's called 45, but it's about the U.S. has finished its war with Japan, but for whatever reason, Germany didn't get into it, so... Germany is still intact. The Nazis are still intact, and they've beaten everybody in Europe. They beat the Russians and they beat the English and all this, and so now it's going to be this face-off between the U.S. and the Nazi superpower, and you know, that's kind of fun, you know. I kind of enjoyed reading that.
But when the author of such a work starts waving around the Nazi flag and pointing it at his fellow Americans, maybe then it's
That's different. Now, I don't think he's gone that far, but he has been. And the other thing that I kind of liked about Newt, and I said, if you read The Wrecking Crew, Newt's sort of one of the villains in it. But not because I think because I thought he was, you know, got history wrong systematically or something like that. It's for other reasons. For example, that he can't. Well, we'll talk about that some other time. But I read his latest book. It's called, what is it? I've got it sitting right here. To Save America.
All right.
Stopping Obama's Secular Socialist Machine. And what's intriguing about this is that Newt has been, up until now, has been one of the more reasonable people on the right. And by that I mean he stood up to Limbaugh. He's distanced himself from this sort of right-wing talker and from that. And then now all of a sudden he's converted and he's calling Obama a socialist and he's doing all the other things that we sort of identify with the sharp turn to the right of the last year. He's clearly trying to position himself, at the leadership of this movement. But that's disappointing. But the sad thing is that Newt knows better. You know, at one point he's basically claiming that labor unions are an alien imposition in America. And that took me all of about, 20 minutes to look it up and find out when the first guild was established in America. And it's like in 1648 or something like that.
That's before there was an America.
Yes, there's been labor has been organized in America since the beginning. You know, there's nothing strange about it. At one point he claims that the liberals or secular socialists or whatever he calls them are out of touch with they don't believe in the America of the frontier. And I was thinking, the frontier closed in 1890, and everyone knows this. It's the famous, it's the groundwork of a famous history essay, one of the most famous history essay, about the closing of the frontier by Frederick Jackson Turner. And Newt knows that. The frontier closed 110 years ago. It's like they can be forgiven for not thinking that we're the Americans of the frontier, because we aren't, and we haven't been for a really long time, And it just goes on and on and on like this, with him trying to grab with both hands for all things that are good and all American, and sort of push this label of alienness onto the other side.
Well, one of the things that I like about what you say is that this machine aims to change the people and overturn the ideals. You know, when these ideals are already, part of America. I mean, it's interesting how.
Oh, and that's also what's really strange about that statement. And let's just take a step back here. Mm-hmm. He says that the secular socialist machine wants to change who we are.
Mm-hmm.
And this is part of their plan to have, permanent power in America. And the funny thing about that is that, he doesn't have any quotes, of course, there's no evidence for this. Okay, this is just something that he's suspicious that they're trying to do. But what's funny is that his colleagues, Tom DeLay, Jack Abramoff, the K Street Project, Grover Norquist, Karl Rove, those guys, actually were trying to do just such a thing a few years ago and were very open about it. Permanent majority. The K Street Project, basically the idea was to put the Democrats out of business forever. And changing America, yes, they called it the ownership society. Gingrich himself had a variation on it that I believe he called the opportunity society. Mm-hmm. But the ownership society was Bush's spin on it. And the idea was that we would make people property owners, and it would change the way they think. They really were going to change the people. And part of this, by the way, was making people homeowners. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons that they were, part of the Bush administration's policy was to get everybody into a house by fair means or, well, I shouldn't say by fair means or foul. That's going too far. But that's one of the reasons why they were so happy to look the other way at, what was going on in the subprime industry, is because of the ownership society. And by the way, they got this idea from Margaret Thatcher, who famously sold off the public housing in England in order to change people's attitudes towards property owning, to make renters into owners. And you'll mint Tories was the idea. And she had a really scary way of putting it. She said, how did she put it? Economics is the method. The object is to change the soul.
That's very
scary.
That's
not Obama that said that. That's Margaret Thatcher that said that. It's spooky, huh?
Yeah, Reagan's soul sister, so to speak.
Yes, and the conservative movement, you know, of which Newt Gingrich was obviously a prominent leader, was following in her footsteps and borrowing these ideas and trying to do the same objectives. And what's funny is that now that they've been beaten, he wants to pin that on the other side. Isn't that curious?
It's so interesting how quickly, positions can just be inverted with complete
impunity. Without reference to reality.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, just putting something in the mirror, and all of a sudden these people are living in an Alice in Wonderland world. They've gone through into the mirror.
Yeah. Another fascinating thing that Newt does, and sometimes I don't think he's being honest when he does these things, because he must know better, mm-hmm. is when he says that that the secular socialist machine, or whatever it is at war with sort of public displays of religiosity because they're grasping for power, okay, because this is part of their grasp for power. And if you think about that for like 3 seconds, it immediately falls apart. If you were really hell-bent on, first of all, on winning elections, you would not constantly be tearing down Ten Commandments monuments. I mean, this is one of the most unpopular things that the ACLU does, you know, and mm-hmm. it's like Democrats are forever trying to distance themselves from it because it's so fantastically unpopular. And the second thing you would realize is if you were really hell-bent on seizing power in America, the obvious thing to do would be to appeal to people's religious sentiment, not to, like, you know, this is a very religious country, not to sort of constantly spit in its face. You know, that doesn't make any sense at all.
Right. Well, I mean, a majority of Americans claim to be religious, and if you protect the rights of...
Oh, my God, it's a very religious society.
Yeah, and if you claim to try to protect the small segment who aren't, you're immediately putting a giant target on
right.
yourself
and so,
that says,
but
don't reelect
me. He surely knows this, you know, this is, or would be aware of it if he thought about it for a few seconds. But it's more fun to dream up these sort of, you know, nightmare totalitarian, you know...
Well, it's not only just alternate history, it's an alternate reality. It's like they've gone through into the Philip K. Dick version of the present, or the Rod Serling version of the present.
You know, that's in a lot of ways, yes, that's true. It's what would you call it? It's a collective fantasy.
Yeah, collective delusion.
Yeah, where they're all these people have got together and have convinced themselves that this thing is going on that there's no evidence for it. They've devolved into sort of mass panic and hysteria. And here's Newt Gingrich, who I always thought of as a fairly level-headed guy, making his bid to, you know, be the leader of the hysterical choir.
Well, also I think it's really interesting that the extremity of some of these positions that has just been, you know, so legitimatized by really mainstream media outlets. I mean, you can't look at you know, CNN or any of the so-called, you know, center mainstream outlets without seeing just one article after another talking about how, I mean, if Sarah Palin makes a speech about handkerchiefs, there's going to be like a 3-minute puff piece on CNN about it.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's the, they're also good. They're good at, you know, she's a superstar, and, you know, she's got that celebrity power.
Now, so we can look for your next column.
Right. But by the way, you know, compared to the sort of hysteria that we're describing, Sarah Palin is not really on the same playing field, you know. She's not anywhere close to Newt or Jim DeMint. You know, I read her book, and it's objectionable in all sorts of ways, but her thing is this personal grievance where she's been wronged by the media. But the sort of grander you know, panic. She's not doing that.
Well, that's a really interesting thought, because it suggests, you know, her paranoia is on a personal scale, and their paranoia is on a...
It's much grander, yeah.
Yeah, so it's on a national and international scale.
Yeah.
And I guess we can see this, the other thing that we can see where this is coming place is the John Birch Society, the comeback for the John Birch Society. It's astonishing. It's like the Flat Earth Society, you know, comes back to life.
Yeah, they're something else. I used to read their magazine when I was in college. It fascinated me.
But it's so contrarian to reality. I just don't understand how it can, you know, get such a firm grip.
Well, it's conspiracy theories. It's an alternate way of explaining history, and to some people, those theories are very satisfying. They seem to explain, you know, a messy situation a lot more cleanly than, you know, the sort of standard, what would you say, professional academic explanations.
Well, it's like seeing patterns in the clouds. Humans are always really need a story. And one of the things that Gingrich and the Tea Party and all these people provide is a really rocking story about,
that's,
you know,
true.
Evil just has come to town and it's taken over.
That's right. And you have to remember one thing about those stories is that they're fun to believe in. It's not just that they're, they're compelling and that they seem to be right and that sort of thing. It's fun to think that you are a patriot and nobody else is and that you're persecuted for it. And this is something that I brought up in my column this week, which is the Tea Party movement has a fairly, you know, anodyne, typical patriotic view of American history. Like George Washington could not tell a lie, you know, and Thomas Jefferson was, you know, the father of democracy or whatever. You know, they believe really, really, really standard things about the great heroes of the Revolution, but it doesn't just stop there. They also believe that they are, you know, some kind of underground rebels for believing this stuff. And what they're believing is like the official history, the stuff that you find in high school textbooks. But they can't just leave it at that. It has to be it's some kind of, you know, subversive alternative history. That's what they're forever telling themselves.
They're rebels with an apple pie.
Yes, that's right.
I've been speaking with Thomas Frank. He's got an apple pie too, and you'll be able to find his writing about it in upcoming issues of Harper's Magazine. Thank you for joining me, Thomas.
Anytime, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.